Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. In its heyday, the Sunflower Ammunition Plant south of DeSoto produced a propellant for World War II, and it became known as the world's largest smokeless powder plant. Today, the 9,000-acre site is being cleaned of contaminants, and plans are being made for its future. We'll get an update and find out exactly what used to go on there. Later on this hour, a whole bunch of cool stuff. We'll have our latest installment of 90 Mile View, which today features a return visit with Dr. Gary Yarbrough, a family doctor down in Parsons. Then, in another installment of A Fan's Notes, we'll hear from Victor Wishna, who will tell us why it feels so good to be a Raider hater. Finally, in today's local listen, it's Katie Guillen and the girls. But first up today, the Sunflower Ammunition Plant. With us is Tom Stutz, who was in charge of the Army staff at the Sunflower Plant and served as the government's top official on the site. And Tom, good to have you. Good morning.
Hello.
Kayla Frazier is also here. She's a third-generation Sunflower Army Ammunition Plant employee. Her grandfather helped build the complex in the early 1940s. Her father worked at the plant for 35 years before retiring as chief of the plant's fire department. Kayla, nice to have you, too.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Matt Gilligan is a curator with the Johnson County Museum and an expert on the Sunflower exhibit that opened recently at the museum. Matt, good morning to you, too.
Morning.
Well, bring us up to speed here, folks. And Tom, let's come to you. What's happening on the site of the plant right now? Is the environmental work done? Where are we? Where do we stand?
Well, there's still quite a bit to do yet.
Mm-hmm.
There's a staff of two Army people there, civil service.
Just two, after all those folks used to work out there.
Correct. There's a contractor that has a contract to clean up the plant. As it stands right now, finances are not so good, so there's essentially treading water, not doing anything right now.
I mean, how much cleanup have they done, and how much do they have to go? Do you have even a rough sense of that?
I'm sorry, I really don't.
Matt, do you have any feel for that?
Gayla?
Gayla? Let's just spin it around the table here.
Well, I had just coming maybe third hand when we met at the plant a few weeks ago. The Army staff said that they were probably about two-thirds finished, I think. And the facilities they still have to clean up have to do with removing some asbestos from buildings and standard demolition. And then they have some pesticides in the ground that apparently are a concern. But they've come quite a way.
I mean, once upon a time, this cleanup was supposed to have been done even long before now, right?
I don't know what those estimates were. We were working hard to get the explosive contamination done before we left the plant in 2001, and most of that was complete. And then when another contractor came on after the Alliant Tech Systems contract ended, they worked for a while on burning buildings, but they were removing asbestos and doing that kind of thing. They did a lot of recycling of concrete, metals, selling government property.
Well, as we sit here today, do any of you know what the future for this site is going to be? We're talking how many acres again? 9,000 acres. What's it going to be 5 or 10 years from now? Do we know?
Well, a private development company took over in 2005, and their plan is to make it a mixed-use residential, green space, retail. So as long as there's still work to do in the cleanup,
I think it's still
up in the air. But they took over in 2005 and have kind of been working towards that since then.
Well, Matt, why did the Johnson County Museum want to do an exhibit on this site? And how difficult of a task did that pose for you guys, trying to figure out how do you do a museum exhibit that sort of represents all this history out there?
We had a really good collection of things from the plant, including a full set of plant newspapers from the 40s all the way to the 90s. That helped us out a lot. A lot of artifacts. And there's also a lot of people who are still around who worked there. So I interviewed a lot of them and would go to their breakfast meetings every month.
And Gayla was one of them.
Right.
And, so
and I met Tom at one of those, too. Mm-hmm. And, it's a really interesting story. It changed Johnson County and the, area in a lot of different ways.
It changed Johnson County how, Matt?
Well, after Pearl Harbor, there's this build-up coast-to-coast of defense plants, and so they pick northwest Johnson County to build this massive plant. It's as big as Leawood, and if you're on the Missouri side, it's as big as Belton, the whole plant.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, why did this thing come to begin with? I mean, why DeSoto, Kansas? I mean,
well, a lot of reasons. Middle of the country, so not as prone to attack or sabotage as a coastal plant might be, which is something they had to think about. Isolated, highly secretive work. Ample water supply, proximity to railroads, and a ready labor market in Kansas City, Lawrence, and Topeka.
And this plant had all that going for it then, right?
Right. And yeah. At its peak, over 12,000 people worked there.
12,000 people.
In 1945, so.
And today, as you said, Tom, two folks sit out there then, eh?
Two Army people, that's correct.
Man, that's got to be a lonely job.
Well, it is, but there's still some land management to oversee and that type of thing, so there's some property to look after.
Well, so Matt, go ahead with your story. So how did you guys put together an exhibit of this
whole thing? Oh, so I just did a lot of research with the plant papers because they really gave a day-to-day almost of what was going on out there, and then talking with the former employees really kind of made the story come together.
Yeah. What did go on out there? What was the whole, Gayla, what was happening out there at the height of the plant's operation?
Well, the largest operation was World War II, and they made several products. They never made an end product, as far as I know. It was always propellants that got sent to other locations.
What does that mean, propellants? I came across that word a lot last night. What is that?
It's what makes the ammunition go. It's an explosive. It is put in a confined space, like contained within metal or whatever.
We're talking grenades or bullets or all those things or what, Tom?
It's basically in the artillery situation. It would be the propelling material that you would put in the breech mechanism of a cannon.
Okay. Right. That's a word I can understand. Yeah. Okay.
And with that, it would obviously, when ignited, would blow the projectile out the tube to the target.
Mm-hmm. And you made a lot of that stuff back in those days. Folks did, right?
We made a lot during World War II and Korea, Vietnam. And then the last production period was a new type of ingredient in propellant called nitroguanidine. That we made
we started in 84.
In 1984 through 1992.
And what did that stuff do?
It was actually a stabilizing ingredient in what was called triple base propellant.
Okay.
And it was still an explosive, but it took a lot to make it boom.
Right. Yeah.
We made a lot of it, and a lot of it was stored, and the Army decided they had enough. And so when they had enough, they closed us down.
So I gather at the height of the plant's operations came in World War II. Did it gradually sort of taper off from that point coming forward?
No, there were a lot of periods of all of a sudden we were finished. And a lot of people would be laid off all at the same time. Some would remain around to do what they called layaway, so that the property could be laid away to be used again in the future, and it was made ready for whatever time frame the Army wanted it to be up and going again.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Army wanted production, we would open everything up, hire more people, bring a lot of people back. Many people were brought back, as many as six times.
Is that right?
Some would transfer out to other parts of the country and then transfer back. In my case, I was laid off in 1973 after Vietnam, and I came back in 1975 when they were building the nitroguanidine plant.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Tom? Were you there permanently, or did you go back and forth?
No, working for the government staff, I came in 75, and that was when the modernization process was really getting rolling.
Modernization meaning?
Meaning we were adding new facilities, upgrading the type of equipment that was used to make the propellants.
Mm-hmm.
The vintage materials were from the 40s were being updated to a more continuous, a safer operation. And when we got into production and for nitroguanidine, we had somewhere around 800 people, I believe the contractor did, on their staff.
How did the number of people working there during the Vietnam era compare to the World War II era? How big a deal was Vietnam?
I think there were 1,200 to 1,800, somewhere in that area.
So not as many as World War II.
I remember it a little different. I think in the Vietnam time frame, I think there were around 4,500 people.
Oh, that's probably right.
And then going back to the Korean time frame, I think there were a little over 6,000 mm-hmm. at that time.
And World War II would have been what then?
12,000.
Gradually coming down the pipe.
Right, 12,000 contractor staff, and there was probably a little over 100 Army
Well,
staff.
And an estimated 20,000 just construction, because construction lasted throughout World War II, and that 20,000 doesn't play into the 12,000, yeah. So an extra 20,000.
So at the Johnson County Museum again, Matt, how do you sort of how do you illustrate all of this? How did you go about the challenge of trying to depict this ongoing changes at the plant?
Right. Well, we kind of broke it down into three. We look at it through three different lenses. The first one is patriotism and mobilization during World War II, and talk about how it really was a full mobilization effort and what a big role women played out there, because so many men were fighting overseas. You know, there was a major labor shortage. So by 1944, 60% of the workforce was women out at Sunflower, and they were doing jobs by then that at the beginning of the war they weren't allowed to do. So they're kind of the heroes of the story in the early years. And then the second lens we look at it through is that Sunflower was an important cog in the military industrial complex, through a Cold War lens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were these like Tom was talking about, periods of standby, reactivation, and that was because of Cold War politics. You know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, mm-hmm. 80s. And the third factor lens that we look through is local factor, how it changed the area.
As a curator, how difficult was it for you to approach depicting something like the Sunflower Ammunition Plant?
Well, I knew that there were going to be really good stories there, and we tried to, you know, we do talk about the process and the numbers and, you know, the real technical stuff, but we really wanted to make it about the people who worked out there mm-hmm. because they were just, you know, everyday people who were really, in a lot of ways, shaping history. We call it, you know, we say shaping history from the heartland, and they played a big role in shaping world events for almost 50 years.
Yeah. You know, Gayla, as I hear you guys talking about this, you know, making the products that you made, it just strikes me as an awfully dangerous place to work. Was it?
It could be, but safety was a huge role at the plant. We emphasized safety. We had many safety meetings. We spent time having daily safety meetings mm-hmm. and just ingrained everyone with the idea that they had to be safe, and we just gave them all kinds of information about what they needed to do to stay safe in their job as well as at home. We did safe driving courses. We did later years stop smoking courses.
I was going to say, Tom, the cigarette smoking really had to be managed, right?
It did. They had it arranged for those people that couldn't stop smoking during the years, and of course that was something that happened a lot by a number of people.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, they had what they call smoking stations, and these were the little metal shacks that I don't know that you could probably get 10 or 15 people in them, nice and tight.
And
the cigarettes mm-hmm. were there, the windows were open, and the lighters were on the wall where you leaned up against the lighter with your cigarette and touched the button to ignite that and have the cigarette. When you left the area, you were checked to see that you didn't take anything with you that would cause a problem later on.
Now, Gayla, my sources tell me that your aunt used to sneak cigs into the plant in her lunch. Am I right about that?
You're right.
What did she do?
She really hated rules. And she told me many years after she worked there that she would sneak cigarettes and matches into the plant by wrapping them in wax paper, which was the only thing available at the time, and she placed them inside her sandwich and then wrapped the sandwich so that she was able to sneak them in that way. I imagine a lot of people learned some things from her.
Well, but if you smoked inside the plant, wouldn't that be fairly obvious?
I think they kind of helped each other, and there were many shifts. If they were working nights, it was probably easier for them, but I think they probably had an outlook, you know, or what you, would you call that? A lookout. Yeah. And they would say, okay, you know, Nick's on the cigarettes. But
so if she made a mistake and took a big bite out of a sandwich with tobacco and matches in there, what would that taste like, do you think?
Well, she probably wouldn't mind it, but it sounds pretty bad to me.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the Sunflower Ammunition Plant just south of DeSoto. It's history in a new exhibit taking place right now at the Johnson County Museum. If you have memories of the plant, maybe you had relatives who worked there and can share a couple stories, we'd love to hear from you. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org or tweet us at @kcuruptodate. Let's go to some calls here. And Mike from Baldwin City. Mike, good morning.
Thank you, man. My grandfather, Merlin Ford, worked out there initially and then was transferred to a nitroglycerin plant in West Virginia. He came out of depression. The money he made from that, from working out there, is what he invested in buying an IGA grocery store that he ran in Baldwin from 1953 to 1980. And then my aunt, Daisy Hemming, learned chemistry on the job out there and retired from there, I think, in the 70s. She didn't know anything about chemistry prior, but she learned it out there and worked out there probably 25, 30 years while her husband was in the Battle of the Bulge during World War II. But I have... Wow. I have a lot of memories of my grandfather and my aunt told me about out there, and we drive through there on old Highway 10 every once in a while. But thank you for taking my call.
Well, Mike, hang on. When you mentioned your aunt's name, Gayla lit up. You knew her, right?
I knew her. I didn't know her real well, but I knew she worked in the labs, and I know she was a very valued employee. She had a lot of friends, and she was very well thought of.
She was my grandmother's sister, and she was a real go-getter. She passed in 2008. But she always had stories about out there and about the war effort and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. All right. Mike, good call. I'm glad you made it. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm also told that people used to hide cigarettes up in the ceilings, too. That sound right?
That's right. We had people who were working on demolition say they would find cigarettes in the ceilings that had false tiles or whatever you call those, and they would find matches, lighters. You name it. They were set up for doing their smoking.
Greg emails us this at uptodate@kcur.org. Any chance the old factory complex will ever be open for tours?
That's something that I'm currently working on right now.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to happen for sure. Hopefully it does, because the exhibit's open till next August, so we do have a pretty good time frame. But we're working on it. If we pull that off, then we'll definitely let everybody know.
Is there
about
much
it.
To still see out there?
There's still 600 buildings.
There's
out
still
there
600. They destroyed a bunch of them, but a bunch are still standing.
Because I think at one point the highest was about 3,000. Isn't that right, Gayla?
Not quite. That's right. Accounts, we called them. They weren't all buildings. The government numbered everything: a bunker, a little thing that would cover a pump. Those things were all numbered.
Yeah.
But one of the things when you mentioned the tour was we gave several tours before we closed the plant. Right. And one of the most interesting was an antique car club that came to drive through the plant. That was a very interesting thing to see all of those vintage cars in a row driving through the plant.
That might have been the same kinds of cars that drove through there back in the 40s,
right? Exactly.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit ago about the safety factor. I mean, Tom, were there accidents out there? I mean, did anything go kaboom and lots of people, you know, struggle or not?
Oh, yes. Yes. As safe as you try to make it, there's always the occasion where something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I'm aware only by people telling me during the nitroglycerin manufacturing process that we did lose a warehouse there. And if I understood them correctly, the sound was enough that you could hear it here in Kansas City.
Wow.
So
I wonder how the fire people, how prepared they were for something to go very wrong out there, given the potential for huge problems.
Well, they were trained to knowing what building they were going to. They knew what kind of problem they could expect. And with that, they would know whether they had to stand back and just protect other facilities or where they were able to go in and actually fight the fire.
Well, Susan writes us this and raises maybe a darker question about the work out there. She writes this: my mother, my aunt, and grandmother all worked at Sunflower during World War II, and they all ended up with breast tumors and died of cancer. My mother and aunt were also sterile, and I also always wondered if it was connected to their work at the ammunition factory.
I can't imagine how it would.
Did many of your friends, your coworkers, suffer from the same kinds of things?
No.
Really? Gayla?
I wouldn't say any more than other people. I'm sure that there could have been some concerns, at least in later years, because of the fact that there were chemicals involved, but there was so much knowledge at that time of what could cause problems and what couldn't, and we never learned of any.
Well, did you guys worry about that, though? I mean, you were there every day. Was it a concern, or did you just become used to it and not really?
I didn't worry about it. I know there were people who, at one time, they were concerned about the cattle on the plant because there were a lot of cattle grazing on the plant. And a study was actually done because there was concern about the cattle eating the grass and taking something up in their system. But the extensive study showed there was no problem.
Oh, really?
Yes. The meat could be consumed with no concern.
Yeah. Well, as you did your work looking at all this, Matt, did you come across any issues as you looked over the old newspapers about safety, health problems that originated maybe at the plant?
Nothing health-wise. Definitely safety. I mean, from our count, over 20 people lost their lives out there working.
Wow.
Most of them were in the World War II era, because there was so much construction, thousands and thousands of people. So there are a lot of accidents that just happened.
You mean construction accidents as opposed to plants, accidents during the preparation of some of these propellants?
Right, but there were those too. And I think the last fatality I saw was maybe in 1980. I found there was an explosion and a couple people
died. And getting rid of some of the facilities out there, there was a contract set up to remove some of the vessels there. And those vessels, by that person, were going to be used to make it slips my mind as to what it was. As it turns out, though, they brought torches into the facility, and on cutting into this tank, some 33-foot long, 9-foot diameter tank laying on its side, sparks fell to the bottom of that tank. Had they put water in the tank prior to that, it probably wouldn't have happened. But as it turns out, it did happen. It blew the end off the tank and blew the tank off the foundation, and I believe a person was killed at that time, and another person was injured.
It's interesting to me that the accidents we're talking about are sort of peripheral to the actual work that went on inside the plant. Does that surprise you, Gail?
No. Because of the stress we put on safety. In fact, it was my understanding of the accident with the tank that the person was told they had to have a hot work permit to do the cutting on the tank, and they didn't do that.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things that was stressed by our safety department. Any hot work had to have a permit, so that at least the fire department would know about it. And in that case, it wasn't done.
Our topic today, the old Sunflower Ammunition Plant. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, and our email address, update@kcur.org. Let's go to Jess from Richmond, Missouri. Jess, good morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
During World War II, my mother and my sister lived at a place called Sunflower Village that was, by my understanding, associated with / adjacent to the plant. I was not yet born, and my dad was in Europe with Eisenhower, and I've just heard stories. My mom's no longer living, but during the rest of her life, I heard stories all my life about living in Sunflower Village and walking two blocks to see the only tree and things like this. I wondered if your guests could address the existence of Sunflower Village and its proximity to the plant, and if it was related.
Matt, and this is folks actually living on the plant site then?
Well, it's across old Kansas Highway 10 from the plant. And it was basically a company town. It was a federal housing project built by the government. And at its peak, 6,000 people lived there.
Is that in DeSoto itself?
Now it's part of DeSoto. It was known as Clearview City for a long time.
Clearview City. Does that ring a bell, Jess?
All I ever heard was Sunflower Village.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the only name they ever called it around our house.
I think they changed the name in the 70s to Clearview City.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, of course, my dad bought veterans housing in southeast Kansas City in 46, and I was born in 47.
Well, Jess, I'm glad you called. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye.
We have an email here from Bob who writes us this. People have no idea of the enormity of the facility. 100 miles of railroads, hundreds of buildings, a bus terminal, a power plant, storage bunkers galore, all built and ready to operate in about a year's time. The history needs to be saved. It's a fascinating story of Johnson County. Mm-hmm. And I gather you wholly agree with that.
Yeah, it's been really interesting doing all the research, beating people who used to work out there. And I got a tour of the plant by one of the two Army guys who they were talking about earlier who's out there. And just driving around and him pointing things out here and there took an hour and a half. It's huge.
Well, was there a talk, 20 years ago about the Land of Oz or the amusement park that was going to be built out there? Do I have that right?
Yeah, it was supposed to be the Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Theme park that I don't think anybody was that interested in. I don't know.
It was talked about for a while. It got people excited.
Were you?
For a
okay.
while. You thought it was a good idea?
I'm kind of like technical things, okay?
Yeah.
And some of the technical things that they had in mind to use at that park I thought were really quite clever. One of the things that was really nice was the children and people would wear badges that the little munchkins could read that read the data from a piece in their head. set and tell what that person's name was and what his interest was. And they could also make arrangements to get on rides.
Wow.
Without having to go stand in line. I thought that was because I've been to Disney World and it takes a while to get through some of the rides. But
it never came to pass, did it?
It was only going to take 60 acres out of the 9,000 acres. And so it wasn't like it was going to engulf the entire facility.
Well, housing does seem to be the most obvious use to accommodate the growing expansion of Johnson County to the south and west, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to make the most sense.
Yeah, DeSoto is one of those places that I think more and more people are moving to and relocating to.
And DeSoto is still in Johnson County?
Right.
Yeah, okay. Back to some calls here at 816-235-2888. The Sunflower Ammunition Plant's our topic. Matt from Baldwin City, good morning.
Oh, hey, good morning. It's an interesting discussion. I had heard years ago that that one of the hazards with some of the older buildings there was that over the course of being used as a manufacturing structure, that walls and rafters and different surfaces had collected kind of a residue, almost a kind of like a gasified and condensed kind of chemical coating that itself was a hazard because it could explode. And perhaps even from, like, slamming the door on the way in or something. And I wondered if indeed that was the case.
Gayla Frazier was nodding her head yes.
Wow. Yeah,
it was an explosive powder residue. And because the buildings were constructed in the 1940s, some of them were double wall construction and they were wooden. And the powder would sift into cracks and crevices. And there had been incidents at other plants of people who had tried, like, prying a board loose or something like that, and there would be explosions.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a hazard, and that's the reason we had to burn those buildings.
Uh-huh. And another thing was I seem to recall that Sunflower Army Ammunition Plant figured into the plot of that movie from the 80s called The Day After.
Oh, the atomic.
Like that was the target or something within the context of that.
What actually happened then was the movie company did come to DeSoto and surrounding areas, and they were seeking extras who would drive their cars and park on 10 Highway that was closed for a while. And it was one of the scenes in the building. And 10 Highway runs not too far from the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, the plant, as far as I know, was not involved, but that was...
No, I suppose within the context of the narrative that they were presenting, was that was actually the target. That was why the Lawrence area got hit, you know, is because of the strategic importance of the plant.
I'm not sure we can answer that one, but interesting call, Matt. I'm glad you called.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. You bet. Bye-bye. Brauka writes us this. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. My dad worked for Hercules for 38 years. I worked there myself during the mid-60s. I witnessed explosions and fires and yet had no fear. I lived as a child in the staff village and went to school in Sunflower Village. What was Hercules?
Hercules was the operating contractor.
Okay.
That's who Gala worked for at the time.
Okay. So no fear. This, he had a good experience. And Eric writes us this. My parents and brother lived in the tar paper shacks that had been built close to house workers during the war. Due to the housing shortage following World War II, this temporary housing was made available to returning military to help them transition back to a civilian life. I had returned to Sunflower several times to do fire protection projects and to some of the leased land on the west side for Army Reserve field training. Tar paper shacks?
Well,
ring a bell?
One of the things when all these people were flooding, because this was coming out of the Depression, it was good wages, so people were coming here from Oklahoma, Missouri, Arkansas to work. And so, like, tent villages almost would appear in Eudora and DeSoto, and, you know, people were sleeping in, like, chicken coops and things. And that's one of the main reasons they built Sunflower Village, because the housing shortage.
Wow. Okay. There's all kinds of history, isn't there?
Yeah,
all kinds of twists on this story. Laura from DeSoto. Laura, good morning to you. Laura, are you there? She had a question about German POWs. Were they ever housed at the plant?
No, not that I'm aware of.
But the story got around back in those days, right? Now, I wanted to ask you, Gayla, this notion that so many women worked at the plant. I've also read that over the years, the women began to sort of stand up for themselves and had to sort of collectively make a stand against the way they were treated in some cases, sexual harassment is how we refer to it today. Tell us about that.
Well, when I first went to work there, women had to wear dresses. All of the management and higher management positions were held by men. We had to...
Just typical, right?
Just typical.
Yeah.
And we had to kind of assert ourselves just to be able to wear pants to work when the pantsuit became popular.
That was a big battle from what I read.
That was a big battle. And the first woman to wear the pants... started something, but she was working in one of the area offices, we call it, which was in the explosive area of the plant, and then it just kind of grew from there. Also, when I first worked there, women were only allowed to work a 10-hour day at the most because we were too delicate to withstand working more hours than
that. How long did some people work out there every day? How long were some of the shifts?
I knew of times when they would be 16 hours, and then in later years, some of our payroll people would actually work around the clock.
Why?
Because there were deadlines to meet, and we did our own payroll. Many times that would happen at times when we had to do W-2s for people, and it would mean an all-night shift to be able to get it done.
Gayla, if safety was such a concern out there, why would you have workers putting in 16-hour days? It seems to me you're just asking for trouble.
Well, in the area, there was a limit to the number of hours they could work.
In the
explosive area, there was a limit. They were not allowed to work shifts to the extent that they would become too tired. But in the office, we could work until we just dropped over.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds like at the end of the day, it was a pretty good place to work.
It was a great place.
I'm hearing nothing but good things here, and you're nodding your head, Tom.
As I moved here in 75, that was known by everybody. You worked out there, Hercules. Boy, that must have been a good job out there.
Well, I should point out that the exhibit at the Johnson County Museum, Citizen Soldiers of the Prairie, runs through April, I think you said?
No, it's August 23rd
through
of
August.
Next year.
And the museum hours, it's free. Museum hours Monday through Saturday, 10 to 4:30. Free admission. You can't go wrong there, right?
That's right.
Okay. I want to thank all our good guests here for coming in and talking about the Sunflower Ammunition Plant. Tom Stutz, Gayla Frazier, and Matt Gilligan from the Johnson County Museum, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, good to have you all here.